Thanks, Julia, for this opportunity. This talk, and actually today's sessions, including my talk and Mario's talk, will be quite different than the ones we've seen before in this program. It will be mostly experimental studies and trying to understand at what scale predictions work and at what scale it fails. And those empirical studies usually come in two forms. One form tries to understand the shape of the energy landscape, shape of the loss surface. How does this high-dimensional loss surface look like? And the other one, so if you have a stochastic gradient descent dynamics, whether this helps you find good solutions or not, usually the studies are on those two lines. And lately in this past year, we've seen some work trying to combine the two together because the interplay between them is also crucial. But if you talk about the landscape, let's just fix the notation and fix what we mean by the landscape. We usually, in the supervised learning setup, it's a crash course on supervised learning, which Florian went over 2 days ago. We have a data set that we assume we sample IID from some unknown distribution. This is different than the IID assumption that people make in statistical physics. It's the images, the pixels themselves are not IID. It can come from any distribution. But suppose there's underlying distribution of, say, cats and dogs, and then you take a set from that, and then you split that set into two parts, and then you use the training set to form the loss function. Once you do that, the training surface is fixed, right? You don't touch that at all, even though you use some noisy dynamics. The landscape you consider is fixed for once, and it doesn't depend on the data set anymore in some loose sense. So this L train will be the surface that we're interested in throughout the talk, and we will try to see what kind of properties this L train exhibit. Of course, the goal of learning is to find good parameters theta that work on the set that is unseen. Let me remark that this assumption doesn't necessarily hold true for many of the data sets that we use in the cutting-edge networks. If you have a language model, the past data you collect is not really IID for the future data you will see. There might be different trends, and the structure of the underlying data distribution might change over time. So to fix some more quantities, number of parameters will be denoted by capital N. A number of examples on the training set will be denoted by capital P. There's a debate between what notation one should use to denote N and P, but this notation is consistent with the 90s statistical physics and machine learning literature, so we will stick with this for the sake of this talk. Okay, so I'll go over two major observations that came out in the past few years regarding the optimization problem in neural networks. The first problem is the benefits of using stochastic gradient descent. So just a quick recap. When we, at the third step, we minimize the loss function. How do we minimize the loss function? We can take the gradient of this guy and follow the steps in a discrete manner, and that scheme will give some kind of minimum. And people used to say that if you follow that scheme, it gets you a bad minimum. So you have to add some noise, which can be done efficiently by using stochastic gradient descent, which is instead of looking at this full sum over the training set, you take a little subset. Let's call this B. And B is a subset of D train. And size of B is much less than the size of D train. So if you use this, you get a noisy estimate of the gradient. And then using that noisy estimate, you can get around those bad points. You could as well use the total gradient and add some noise, but it's very costly. So instead of using that, you could use the stochastic gradients, and you could make use of the noise that is induced by the stochastic gradients. And this hindsight, this common knowledge, so to say, goes back to early 90s on stochastic gradient methods in neural networks, there's an explicit reference on the fact that the gradient descent, the total gradient method, cannot escape a local minimum. And if you dig it a little further, you see that it refers back to this Burilli paper in 1989. We will take a look at that too. So that paper is a paper that attempts to parallelize the model, but on the way of running those experiments, they find out that there is a problem of getting stuck at local minimum. So you have to find ways to improve this algorithm that you use to roll past a local minimum. But of course, if someone tells you not to use gradient descent and use stochastic gradient descent, like as a bad boy, what you do is just go do it, right? You go and test it. And then when you do it in a relatively modern, compared to the 1980s sense, in a relatively modern network, you see that they go to the same loss value. They don't necessarily find the same point. Of course, it's a huge space. This n, the dimension of the weight space, is half a million in this case. But the loss values it finds on the test set and on the training set are the same.
So you used full batch for gradient descent?
Yes. It takes a long time. It takes a very long time. And those curves are averaged. And this is number of iteration axis, and this is the loss axis, right? So to get this SGD, you can do it in several hours, get several runs, but for gradient descent, you have to wait days. Yes?
Do you have an equivalent figures also on underparameterized networks?
No. But I'll come to that.
It depends on the size of the training set.
The training set size is fixed.
Change by a factor of 10, the curve will change?
The curves will probably follow the same thing, same curve. I suspect this depends on n. If the model is underparameterized, you're not going to get the same thing. And part of the end goal in this talk is to see that there's a phase transition between underparameterized and overparameterized models. In the underparameterized case, you see what the people in the 80s see. Because, if you go back to this paper, and if you look closely, they had only 5 hidden neurons. So there's a structural difference on the landscape, depending on how many parameters you use.
Right? Still a lot from the 80s.
Yeah, right? The image is 20 by 20. Yeah, so, but...
What's the size of B?
Sorry?
What's the size of B?
100. So 100 versus 60,000. Okay. There's a huge scale. But again, depending on the data complexity, that scale is also important. So one important aspect of this experiment is that we have to use small enough learning rate that is fixed for both of them. We can't, so different batch sizes take different learning rates, right? If you use a more stable algorithm with the gradient descent, you can actually use larger learning rate. It's going to be more stable. But if you increase the noise by decreasing the batch size, you sort of make the algorithm more unstable. And if it's unstable, you have to use a small learning rate. So you have to find a small enough learning rate so that both algorithms converge, and then wait until the same number of iterations has been observed, and then see where they go. But then if you look at the test accuracy, if you look at the number of misclassifications on the test set, on the unseen set, you see that on average, there's a gap. So the test set contains 10,000 examples. And on average, the gap is 20, which doesn't look like much, which is not much, which is not enough to refer to those 90s papers to justify that intuition that stochastic gradient descent is much better. Right? It's not enough, but there's a gap. So where does this gap come from? And another, maybe a partial answer to Marco's question is that if you reduce this n by a factor of 10, this gap increases from 20 to like 50 or 60. Again, it's not much. But
it's still favorable to SGD.
Yes, it's still favorable to SGD. But the question begs, if we take n to infinity, is the gap going to close? Again, it's not an exact answer, but this, all those four mean field papers that came out last year, they kind of hint at the fact that in the limit, the gradient flow itself is enough to find the solution, the unique solution in the density. So maybe in that limit, there's no difference between gradient descent and stochastic gradient descent.
Sorry, in that limit, you take the batch size small but still proportional to n, or small and fixed?
Small and fixed. No, I mean, so in those papers, the way it's formulated, there's no strict difference between gradient descent and stochastic gradient descent. So it doesn't really fit into the framework that we use here. But
these are pretty different. In one case, also B diverged, and so in the thermodynamic limit, you don't expect large fluctuation in the gradient.
Yes.
If you take B large but not diverging, you always have a fluctuation. So the two limits physically expect to bring different models. One
yes.
is a zero temporal model, the other is a finite temporal model. So what is the limit in that?
In those papers, what I gather from those papers is that if you use gradient descent, you'll get the best you can get in a one hidden layer network. So stochastic gradient descent cannot beat it in some sense. It can do worse in that limit.
The best in which class of models? Because I don't think they can prove something in all possible models.
The best in those papers, don't they assume infinite number of data? I mean, it's like online learning.
Yes,
you can never be in the regime where n the number of parameters is much larger than the number. I mean, they take sort of.
Yeah, but the algorithm is using minibar size 1, assuming p infinite.
Exactly.
That's why it's not the same regime, it's not the same framework. Here, p is fixed. You can change the batch size, so there are different parameters that are different there. So the setup is completely different, but in some sense, in that framework, there's no strict difference between SGD and GD. You can find a bad initialization, even in that framework, that would give you...
How can one claim that gradient descent is the best algorithm if in that regime you are not able to study a set of algorithms where the limit is taken differently?
I don't know.
Okay.
Yeah, good point.
Just to understand the scope of those papers, because for what I understand, they are not covering all possible way of making P large, B large, and N large.
Exactly. I don't know. So in the finite P, changing the batch size, how this limit would work out, it's unclear.
What does it mean initialized correctly?
it's a big debate these days. Initialized correctly, I mean, you can always find adversarial initializations that would screw the system and in a manner that it would not converge. The network, you know, in some sense would not propagate any signal or... So if you, if you scale things properly, then they converge to a certain limit. Otherwise, they don't. So initialized properly is a bit. There are like different initialization schemes that give you different kinds of limits. One of them is this mean field approach. The other is the kernel approach, and they imply different results, slightly different results. Yeah. And we can discuss that maybe from the scaling point of view later on.
So I don't know if you're going to discuss this, but something that has been said by many practitioners or superintendents is that in a certain sense, gradient descent, what it's doing is want to minimize the, training loss or the in-sample loss, whether stochastic gradient descent is more minimizing the test loss or the out-of-sample loss. That is at least the way in which it is solved. For example, they will do these kind of things. People like cerebral say these kind of things. So
if you use a fixed training set size, there's no way stochastic gradient descent optimizing the expected loss. If you take, so it also depends on the kind of framework you use.
Sure, I mean, if you do one pass, yes. If you use a finite number of data, depends how big is it, right? So it's true that you go over again, but so it's true that you, I mean, the way, I mean, in principle, you have the wave, at a certain point, you lose cloud.
If you have infinite data,
yeah,
then there's no way of doing gradient descent in some sense, right? But if you, in infinite data case, if you do online learning, if you assume that you can, you have access to unlimited new samples, then maybe that's the way in which stochastic gradient descent is optimizing the true loss as opposed to the empirical loss. Because whenever you do gradient descent, you force yourself to a finite sample size.
Yeah.
But other than that, if the sample size is fixed, like if you fix with this paradigm on slide one, then I think what you optimize in stochastic gradient descent and gradient descent in both cases is just the training surface and nothing else. You optimize the empirical loss. Because even if you use stochastic gradient descent, the test loss, you see it increases.
Yeah.
And the only way that that can possibly make sense is that you have to have access to infinite data. And maybe that's why these papers show this, in this different regime, they show sort of an equivalence.
But at the same time, there should be a, I mean, it's a length of data at which one pass becomes almost like, it's not different than just. What I mean is that if I use stochastic gradient descent, okay, if I get the data that I had, I don't know, 10 to the 7 step before, okay, there is a slight correlation between the rate at which I am with the data because they see that.
Yes.
Data, but, I mean, it's small. So it's there is an effect, but maybe at a certain point, if you just neglect it, you can think that even though you're going through the same data, it's almost like to one pass.
Yes, it's possible. I don't know if there is a if something like this is empirically observed, like if P is so large that we can actually observe this, but it's possible. So depending on the data set, there are also the generalization gap that we've seen, like it was 20 examples, it can also increase. It can so this is a paper that came out in 2016 at iClear. The scaling, the time scaling is a bit weird because they use number of epochs in time scaling. And if you compare an algorithm with a larger batch size, of course, per epoch, it will take less number of iterations. It will make less number of iterations. So the time scale is a bit skewed. But even then, in the limit, you see there's a gap, a substantial gap, 2%, 3%. Okay. But then this generalization gap turns out that this generalization gap can be filled if you correctly tune the hyperparameters of the model. You can increase the batch size, and as you increase the batch size, if you also increase the learning rate linearly, so if you fix this constant, then up to a certain limit, you can increase the batch size without sacrificing performance. And this is one of the first examples of such an experiment on ImageNet, that the batch size can grow up to 8,000. And people later on made it go up to 32,000. So the idea behind this is that up to a certain scale, your algorithm goes to the same point if you tune the learning rate and the batch size proportionally in a linear way. And there is an interplay between overparameterization and data complexity. And if the data is more complex, you need maybe more overparameterized models, but maybe you can't fit that big of a model in the set. So you need to study the optimal learning rate and batch size ratio depending on different data sets and different complex data sets. So what this paper does is that they measure the gradient noise scale, which is measured by looking at the variance of the gradients at each point. And if the noise is smaller than the mean gradients, they say, okay, this is the optimal batch size. And at that point, you need to do learning rate search to get the best performance. So if you do that with different data sets, you see that there's a linear scaling. There's a scaling between the critical batch size and the gradient noise. And this seems to hold in various complex data sets. The way it's usually justified, not in the McCandish paper, but in the one of the first papers that proposed this linear scaling of learning rate divided by batch size, usually goes through a Gaussian assumption. If you take a batch size that is large enough, then you can see this sum, as you can interpret this sum in the stochastic gradient algorithm as a Gaussian sum, and the noise would be the total gradient plus some Gaussian noise. So this allows people to justify that different temperatures, in some sense, if you take this quantity as a temperature, different temperatures allowing you to find solutions with different properties, like different width. But this assumption may not hold true, because the noise typically is not Gaussian. So if you look at the norm of the noise, when you calculate gradients subtracted by the mean of the gradients at each step, you see that the norm of the noise is more like an alpha stable distribution. It has heavier tails than the Gaussian. So this is what would happen if the norms were Gaussian, and this is what would happen if it was if it had heavier tails. And what we see in real life is that the noise distribution has heavier tails, so this Gaussian assumption fails in some sense. So we need other explanations on why tuning learning rate divided by batch size gives us different qualities of solutions. Why is this important? Why is increasing batch sizes important? Because it allows us to parallelize the models. So, you know, there's a sequence of papers that came out in 2018, and they all try to break the record of how fast you can train ImageNet to get a really good accuracy. You know, this one's by Facebook. They do it in 1 hour using, I don't know how many GPUs in parallel, maybe 256 or 512, I don't know. This is a blog post that you can train it in 18 minutes with if you only spend $40 on public servers. This is by a team in Berkeley taking it down to minutes. How many minutes? I think it was 10 or 11. And there's yet another one.
If they give you the parameter that they fine-tune after 4 years of work claiming that you can do it in minutes, it's
cheap. I just did it on my tablet.
So the final one is training in seconds, so if you know the title, we can extrapolate the titles. Training ResNet X in Y seconds. So that's the first observation. There is an interplay between the hyperparameters of the algorithm and the kind of solutions we find.
So what did they do in these sequence of papers? You know, what make all the improvements possible? What are the improvements?
I don't really know. Okay. I don't know. I think the hardware. Yeah, I mean, the main trick is increasing the batch size, and they don't use the same hardware. But so if you increase the batch size and the learning rate linearly, and if you make sure that the algorithm converges with the same accuracy, then the computational cost is somewhat the same, but you can distribute it. When you distribute it, you can make it much faster. So it takes it takes many iterations to go from the initial point to the final point, but if you use a larger batch size, which can take larger learning rate, each step can be distributed parallelly, and then you can get the information, aggregate, and then take the step, and that gives you a far less number of iterations to converge.
Knowing these might require a lot of additional work, which might not be generalizable to other data sets, or, you know, Florian saying they spent 4 years optimizing the parameters.
Yeah, but so the goal is to increase the batch size without sacrificing accuracy, right? And so, okay, the goal is to actually increase the batch size. And here it's the learning rate, and this curve gives you the constant performance. So you can increase it up to a certain point. If you increase learning rate for a really large batch size, then the algorithm diverges, you get a poor point.
Sure.
At this scale, if you cannot increase the learning rate any longer, you don't gain any benefits of distributing the systems, you just waste computational power. So the optimal batch size is somewhere here, and that gives you the best performance. And this is what this paper does on several data sets. They can just, like in a somewhat principled way, find this critical point to train the models faster with the parallel distributions, with the parallel GPUs, without sacrificing performance.
What's about it? I mean, each batch you computed on one GPU, or what?
Each batch you computed in several GPUs. And each batch is the gradient of sums, right? You can distribute it into how many GPUs you have, compute the gradients, collect them, add them up, and then take the step. So each GPU is taking smaller samples of data sets.
Each GPU is doing some kind of small batch itself?
Each GPU is doing small batch, then you add them up, so you make one step.
Sorry, when you say the noise is not Gaussian, it's more alpha stable with roughly what is the value of alpha?
1.2,
1.4.
That's really heavy. Yeah, it's very, very heavy tailed. It's it depends on data sets and architectures, but the exact value.
So meaning that the variance not exist? And then remember alpha is it's the problem as one plus alpha.
Here, so if you, like, we scale width and depth, and measure alpha at every fixed point. So it doesn't really, depending on the data set, you know, on CIFAR-10, it doesn't really change much. It's between 1.1 and 1.2. On MNIST, it's between 1 and 1.4. So this one, this figure shows the average alpha scaling with the width. On the left side and on the right side, it shows you the accuracy, the performance. Of course, as you increase the width, the performance increases. The training set goes 100% after some time, and the test set just keeps increasing. And the alpha, the index, stabilizes around 1 and 1.1. So, you know, what it means is that the continuous analog of this process is a Levy process. The noise is a Levy process, and it jumps around. And some recent metastability literature implies that the way it jumps and the kind of solutions it finds, I mean, if you have two basins, the stable distribution doesn't depend on the height between the basins, but rather it depends on the width only. So it might have metastability literature.
Yeah.
I guess Anton Bouvier and maybe several. There are some more references on that I can share later. But and this might have some implications on the actual stochastic gradient descent process, but the landscape isn't composed of isolated minima. So how these two frameworks coincide, I don't know.
The spectrum of the noise you showed, what was it exactly? Because the noise is very anisotropic too, right? It depends on the direction you look at. And if you're in one point in phase space and you take random batches and you study which direction the noise
yes.
is going to be. There are some directions that get a lot of noise and others very little. What is average on all directions?
So this plot is, given your batch size, you calculate GI, and I is sampled. I is just a sample of gradients with this batch size minus mean gradient. And then you look at the norms of this across all I, all possible I.
GI is for a batch?
J is for a batch. So you calculate the total mean. So you fix the point, you fix the parameters on the training landscape. You calculate the mean gradient, the actual gradient on that surface. And then you calculate all possible, not all possible because there's too many possible, but many possible stochastic gradients with that fixed batch size, and now you look at their norm distribution.
Okay. And does the distribution change during evolution?
It does a little bit, and this is what the time scale. So I think it's this figure. See, like this is how it changes if the iterations. The tail index.
You try to relate it to the fact that the noise is very anisotropic in phase-based directions. I get almost no noise and others.
Yeah, so we could do that. We didn't do that. But you should do that. Yeah. But at every fixed point, this tail is heavier than the Gaussian tail. And like it essentially means that once in a while, you get those very large gradients that might allow you to jump from one point to another. It doesn't necessarily mean that you'll end up at a totally different basin because the structure of the basin is somewhat unconventional, which is the second part of the talk.
Alpha is defined such that the tail decays as 1 plus alpha.
Yes. No, it's just alpha, right?
Just alpha.
Yeah. Because 2 would be Gaussian. If alpha is 2, it would be Gaussian. Okay, so the second part is how the landscape looks like at the bottom of the surface. So what are the structure of the minima? There's this huge debate around sharp minima and wide minima, whether you know the algorithm guides you, biases you to wider minima that allows better generalization. And this discussion is also actually quite old. And this is something that you would see in Ricardo Zecchina's talks too. What he means by this local free entropy is essentially convolving the landscape with a Gaussian kernel so that you somehow get rid of sharper basins and emphasize wider basins. And this is what the optimization community in the 90s have been, or maybe even earlier, have been thinking about. But it's hard to make it work algorithmically, so what he proposed is actually an approximate algorithm that might be, even though those parallel workers are working on the actual training landscape, maybe their center is optimizing the convolved landscape. That's the basic premise of the local free entropy idea. But it's essentially just trying to convolve the landscape with a Gaussian kernel. So that intuition of wide minima should be the better ones that we should target is it has been around for a bit. So if we find a solution and look at the eigenvalues of the Hessian, what we see is that you know at the initial point, it's a nice symmetric distribution. Here the plot shows the order of eigenvalues and the values on the y-axis. So the smallest negative one is here and the largest positive one is over there. You know, we see that at the bottom, it looks like almost all of them are zero, except for this little kink. And if we zoom in to the kink, we see that there's only a few eigenvalues that are large, and the rest is almost zero. And if we use a different algorithm, like small batch and the large batch, we get almost the same spectrum, except for the first 10 of them. So many papers that calculate a width for the basin, what they are calculating is actually sensitive to those, you know, top 10 dimensions. So it also turns out that these outlier eigenvalues are correlated with the number of classes you have in the data set. So if you use MNIST, it's roughly 9 or 10 large eigenvalues. If you if you train MNIST to learn odd numbers and even numbers, you get 2 large eigenvalues. That's popping up the spectrum. And a recent work is calculating the gradients, the stochastic gradients, and looking at the overlap of those gradients with the top k eigenvalues, where k is the number of classes in your data set. And it turns out that even though at the initial point, the overlap is close, is not really quite meaningful, very quickly, after 50 or 100 iterations, the gradients live in that space. So gradients point to the sharp directions of the valley, but the rest of the solution space is somewhat flat.
An eigenspace of what?
of the Hessian of the loss. So this is not converged. This is you measure it at every step. Yeah, at every time. That's another interesting feature of it. You might expect that this eigenspace would change in time, because at every time you calculate it at a different point. But it turns out that it's quite stable. You know, since then it's really almost a fixed subspace. There are also several measures of how fixed that this subspace is in that paper. I think right now what they are working on is to develop an algorithm that would exploit this structure. So if the landscape is so flat in some sense, then you would not expect to run into barriers, and there are several papers on this. One of this is our first paper is a collaboration. We look at the mean square displacement of the weights under stochastic gradient descent with various models and data sets. We see that there are different phases, but in none of those phases we see a barrier crossing, especially at the bottom of the landscape. So at the bottom of the landscape, we see a nice diffusive behavior of the weight growth. Another paper is using this string method. So string method is just taking k points, and at every iteration you equally distribute those points between their endpoints, and then you let them fall off. You let them follow the descent algorithm, so that it finds the endpoints find minima, and on the way you can locate saddle points. So if you actually use that on a neural network landscape, this paper by a group in Heidelberg showed that you can actually connect solutions between any minima. So the way they run their experiments is that they take random initial points and let the dynamics go. They run the same dynamics. So they use the same batch size, same hyperparameter tunings, but they start at random initial points, and they take different random shufflings of the data in the stochastic gradient descent. It is still somewhat unknown what happens if you use different algorithms. So if you use a gradient descent or stochastic gradient descent, can you connect them? Presumably yes, but you could also do adversarial training. So you could train on, training set plus shuffled labeled test set, and you could train on training set plus correct labeled test set. So one of them would get you 100% accuracy on the test set. The other would give you 10% accuracy on the test set. And you would find two different solutions, presumably with different norms. Can you still connect that? Is it still in the same basin? That's not known, but we can just apply this technique to find out. One question was how special the stochastic gradient descent algorithm is, and the other question is the landscape appears to be quite flat. So how can we combine the two in a simple toy model? So I think one toy model that I can think of is the following. Suppose you have a simple function, f of theta is theta squared, and then you redundantly overparametrize it. Make it theta 1 times theta 2 squared. So if you do this, what happens is that this minima, this single minima, corresponds to all the theta 1 and theta 2 is equal to 0 lines. So the level curves of this would be something like this, right? So if you start at a random point, and if your algorithm is not noisy enough, you find a solution around here. And if it's noisy, the gradients will bounce back and forth in those sharp directions, right? The eigenvalues of the Hessian at the solution here, is one is positive in this direction, depending on the distance to zero. The other will be zero, exactly. So if you have a noisy algorithm, you might end up at a different place. And if you start at a random initial point with a noisy algorithm, you might end up again at a maybe similar distance to zero, but in a slightly different part of the landscape. So when you measure the width, you are actually measuring this distance, and it appears as if one of them is, one basin is sharper than the other, but they're essentially in the same basin. And if what many people do is to take a line interpolation and look at the loss. So if you take a line interpolation like here, and if you evaluate the loss, you'll see that one basin is wider than the other, again giving you the illusion that one basin is, you are like in distinct basins, one is wider than the other, but they're essentially in the same basin because you can connect them by this broken linear path. So this captures some of the features that we observe, but I don't really know, for instance, how to make this way more or over-parameterized. It doesn't essentially capture the under-parameterized versus over-parameterized difference.
It's a nice example to show that if you weight the minimal, the flat points, according to the local entropy, you kill the over-parameterization, because the center, the origin is the point having the largest local entropy.
Yes.
So if you give an extra weight proportional to the entropy, you take this flat region, you make it again a single minimum.
Yeah, yeah. But so that in practice, that algorithm, like if you can sample from all over, then you'll find the center. But if you start your k-workers from somewhere here, then what you find is again some point in the valley. You're not going to find the center.
That local entropy. An extra way.
A little, yes, but
if
that.
An extra way, then there is really a non-zero gradient towards the origin.
Little bit, yes, but you can get that extra bias by increasing the noise too. So maybe that's just what's happening. So I'm not sure, you know, in practice, if we compare a gradient descent plus some Levy process and compare that local entropy approach, I'm not sure which one will give you better solutions and how it depends on the actual tuning of the noise. So and speaking about overparameterization and underparameterization, we need to propose a definition of overparameterization at some point, because we see that, you know, there are some interesting features in the underparameterized case. We see somehow like a bad landscape, or maybe some kind of glassy dynamics. But if the number of parameters is large, then the landscape becomes very nice, and optimization is actually very easy. So, you know, with whatever algorithm you use, you can actually optimize. And you only compromise just a little bit of performance, and that can be fixed by properly tuning the learning rate. So what happens is that you can actually make that transition between underparameterization and overparameterization is quite, you can make that transition very sharp. And we need to resort to a trick to do this. And that trick is to switch from cross entropy loss to hinge loss. So it doesn't compromise performance, but it gives you a sharp, precise stopping point. This way you can reach exact zero loss and 100% constraint satisfaction. So you can make your resolution is much sharper. And if you do that, depending on the number of parameters and number of training examples, you can actually find the phase space. So the phase space, you can find the theoretical upper bound. So this tells you that for every degrees of freedom, how many examples can you classify? And those examples are chosen in a generic way. So it's generic p points lying on a d-dimensional space. So it turns out that the upper bound is that for every degrees of freedom, you can classify half a point. So that this constant is 2. It's a simple argument following the stability condition imposed on the Hessian eigenvalues. And what you expect is that in reality, of course, you can do better, because depending on the structure of the data, per degrees of freedom, you can maybe classify more examples, because if they are somehow nearby and clustered, you can expect to separate them easier. And this is indeed what happens in practice. And there is a line that actual transition line that depends on the structure of the data, for which above you reach exact zero loss on the training surface, and below you have a positive loss value. In experiments,
for the phase diagram, it's for what model, and what is the precise? Is there a model, underlying model that you can study?
In principle, this should hold for any model, but the upper bound is quite crude. And in practice, this line is way below the upper bound. But what's challenging is to find this line, this actual line, depending on different data sets and architectures. What we've shown is only on the fully connected models and random data and MNIST. Of course, random data is a bit harder to classify. So this line, again, this is the upper... Sorry?
Random data.
Random data, like random pixels.
Oh, you're doing... Oh, so it's two things, MNIST and... So
this is binary classification. Even in the MNIST case, the classification is reduced to evens and odds as opposed to actual numbers. So in the random data case, you have random pixels and label them plus minus one, again, in a random fashion. Right? So classifying that is a little bit harder than classifying MNIST. And you see that in this phase diagram too. So you can classify more MNIST examples per degrees of freedom, in some sense. So this n star, this critical number of parameters, depends quite heavily on the structure of the data set. But this is, in some sense, classifies this sharp transition between two phases that we've been observing historically. Now, another interesting feature is that we can fix p and then scale n and then see how generalization depends on the number of parameters. This is again on fully connected models and MNIST binary classification plus minus ones. So if you fix number of data points at 10,000, 20,000, and 50,000, we see that the generalization, the test performance, increase like exhibiting the classical bias variance dilemma of machine learning, what we see in textbooks. But after some time, it decreases. So this is only this axis is only number of parameters. We can scale, we can rescale that axis and divide it by n star, which is the critical point of jamming, right? Like if you go back, this increased n star is increasing depending on p. If we renormalize number of parameters with n star, what we see is that it coincides. This peak coincides for all curves, and its value is at 1. So what this means is that if you look at the training error would come down to 0 and stay at 0 for the rest of the model. So each dot here is an experiment, each one is a different model. So this is model capacity scale in some sense. So what happens is that in one regime, you recover the classical overfitting, a classical regime of overfitting. And in the other regime, in the overparameterized regime, you see this decreasing error, increasing performance. So what we observe is on neural networks, but this is also observed very recently on tree-like models too. As you increase the model complexity, you see this classical phase, and then as you increase it further, you see increasing performance.
Sorry, which three models?
Like random forests.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And apparently this observation is also somewhat old. I mean, the observation of increasing the number of parameters, number of degrees of freedom in a model gives you improved performance is quite old. In the 90s literature, many people look at the parameter p divided by n, so number of training examples divided by number of parameters. But this paper from 1996 looks at what we've been looking at, fixing p and increasing n. So number of parameters are increased here per pattern. And if you do that, you see an increasing performance. But of course, it has 50 training examples. It's quite quite tiny. But this kind of effect apparently has been observed in the past too. This is something I just found out very, very recently. Another observation is that, okay, we see, so we can repeat this experiment, right? This is consistent. We can repeat it many, many times. And if you do it many, many times, the average curves still follow this sharp peak and the decay. And we can infer the decay rate depending on the number of degrees of freedom too. But what's more interesting from my point of view is that if you ensemble the outputs of those functions, of those models that you find, you see that you can reach the best performance you can get in this scheme by ensembling right after the transition point. And so, okay, it's a good sign because you can have 20 models with, I don't know, a little bit more than 10 to the 3 degrees of freedom, as opposed to having several orders of magnitudes larger model. It is much more efficient. It's computationally efficient, but it's also even a little bit better. So this point is actually doing a little worse. So there's a gap between the ensemble accuracy you get here right after the transition point and the best accuracy you get over there. So what accounts for this gap? We don't know. We don't know. There are several plausible explanations. One of them is learning is happening here. So if you look at the way the systems evolve, here you don't evolve much. You move just a little bit from the initial point, right, in the large end limit. But here, you actually have to train the system quite a bit. So one might argue that actual learning of the weights is happening here in this regime. And here, you know, what Francis Bach calls is lazy, it's the lazy learning regime. You don't move. All the weights move, but they just move just a little bit. So whether this gap is consistent across data sets and models, we don't know. We're trying to find that out. But overall, I think there are several open questions in this field that some of you already pointed out some of them. So you know, what controls the dynamics of stochastic gradient descent and how it's linked to generalization? We should study it in further detail and further generalization, because now, you know, the models we have are fully connected and binary classification of amnest, evens, and odds. We should scale them. I mean, like, one problem with scaling is that if you look at some cutting-edge examples, for instance, like pose estimation by video, the largest batch size you can have on this model is 1. Batch size 2 doesn't fit. If you look at some large-scale language models that Google is using these days, the batch size that they use is at the order of millions. If you use thousands, it doesn't work. It's way too noisy. It doesn't work. And this is a regime where they have infinite data. They can't even make one pass of the full training set. So there are very different scales, and how, like, the things that we find here, how do they generalize to those cases, is unclear. Like, how can we come up with scientific predictions that actually predict what happens, scientific models that actually predict something in the large scale cases? I think we are not at that scale yet. And in this model of gap between ensembling right after the transition point and the final point, there is a role of the prior too. If you use convolutional nets, maybe that gap is larger, and maybe it's due to the priors that Mario will talk about tomorrow. Is it because of the priors, or is it not? It's unclear. So there are many open questions, and I think we should push the field a little bit towards having an impact on actual practical applications. And that's it. Thank you.
I have a question. On the last plot that you showed, where the ensemble average performs best just after the jamming, if you use a loss function which doesn't go to zero, so for the decay,
yeah,
you can repeat the same experiment even if n star is not well defined. You find similar result or not?
I didn't try, but I bet yes. In terms of this doing better than the final point, yes, I think so.
So maybe you lose the peak. So
you actually see the peak a little bit. So it goes a little. There's a trend. You see the trend, but it's blurry.
It's not sharp.
It's not sharp.
Maybe I could comment also on that. I mean, this peak also depends. It's related to the divergence of the norm of the function at this point. The output function explodes at this point. If you have a finite time on which you simulate, if for infinite times we think that it will diverge, but we see that if we lose smaller and smaller times, this peak is reduced. If you are using cross entropy, there would still be a sort of critical point where the data would separate, but then what happens is that the waves go to infinity very slowly. So it's a bit of a mess to analyze. In practice, you need to put a cutoff time. And so that would sort of smooth this transition, and you cannot study it very sharply. You see. But there would still be something.
Yeah, but from the point of view of generalization accuracy, I think we would still see the gap between this error and that error.
Yeah.
Just a question. There's this kind of lazy learning regime where you change the weights very little.
Yeah.
Does this transition point lie in this lazy learning regime?
No, I think lazy learning happens here, not here.
But I mean, isn't lazy learning what's supposed to happen in the beginning, where the weights change very little? Usually the weights change very little, but then effects and all that.
You might be right, because if you look at the norm growth, the norms grow quite a bit in this regime, and the norms grow little in the overparameterized regime. But even in the overparameterized regime, the amount of growth decreases as you increase n. So even though from the point of view of norms purely, the change is not much in the overparameterized regime, but if you look at the number of iterations it takes to converge, it's far less in the large n limit.
So, maybe to bounce on that, I mean, when n goes to infinity, it's true that the weights change very little.
Yes.
But this asymptotic behavior precisely breaks down at this n star, because there, if you wait long enough, the weights actually would diverge even. So,
okay.
So that's really the point where this asymptotic behavior, I mean, n has to be much larger than n star to start to see this.
To
see that sort of scale where
okay.
You need to move beyond.
That makes sense.
And maybe one order of magnitude larger is enough, right? And I mean, here that norm growth stops, and here it's the point where it starts doing worse.
Other questions? I have a couple of questions. When you say the situation of the gradient, so it's an alpha, what looks like an alpha scale model, how much this depends on the data? So, I mean, for example, imagine that instead of using mean static so far, you use a teacher student. Or, I mean, also, even very, very, I mean, when people do convex, I mean, in terms of the convex landscape, you use stochastic gradient descent. In that case, I guess it's not an alpha scale. It's no problem, but it's,
I don't know. I didn't look into it.
I wonder whether it's a property of the data, and so if you go back to simpler things, like a student forum, and when you go to the convex case, whether things become nicer. Interesting to see.
Yes.
There is no weight decay at all here.
No.
Right, but you see, when you take n going to infinity, you have the kernel limit. What people will do with kernel is just to play with the L2 norm and see what kind of result you have.
Mm-hmm.
And so here, essentially, what you are saying, extrapolating, is that this thing is beating the kernel limit without optimizing gamma. I mean, it might be that, for instance, J just this, you know, gap here. It's just the kind of thing you will get by optimizing and you know, some, do some cross-validation in some in the regularization and going to infinity.
I mean, the regularization you have in mind includes you use for components because
it's
L
to norm.
The same that
L to norm, a weight decay.
Oh,
it's
a weight decay.
Whatever you want to call it. Yeah, just. I'm not sure, it might even make things worse, right?
Well, I mean, that's something that Levent is studying very systematically.
If you run the same experiment.
No, but I mean, it's not even require some work. You take an infinity, you have an analytical formula, you can compute the performance of the kernel, you run it with four different values of gamma.
Mm-hmm.
What is the best one?
What do you mean by gamma? You mean the
value of the weight decay. The ridge regression. So you do kernel ridge regression.
Yeah.
It's not the same to do the regularization on the kernel where you have the L2 norm of the weight, or to regularize the bitnet with a constraint on the
weight. Yeah,
but
I mean, here you are looking to the infinite value and you compare with the infinite value. So you compare to the kernel limit. I mean,
yes, but
if I do a kernel and I put some weight, I will hardly call this really, you know. I mean, if putting a weight decay on the kernel is making me better, I would hardly consider this as, you know, I have learned much, right? And I mean, I'm just worrying about, you know, this tiny improvement things and making very strong conclusion on these deeps.
Which conclusion?
Well, like,
that
you know, that you learn something here, but maybe what you are learning is that, I get some better margin with respect to the point, and it's you know, I mean, it's going in your direction, like, you don't want to interpret this on learning from what I understand.
Okay, that's the result for
and
2 days ago, which I told you. Well, it's Mario's result, that even if he, I don't know if he had time to come, yeah, they haven't, no. So, yeah, it's true that even if we freeze, when you look at the deep net, there is a kernel associated to that, but you can also sort of freeze it and really do a kernel dynamics and compare it to path dynamics. And it's true that in that case, we still find a deep there. So it's not clear that this deep is really a benefit of learning features. Right, but it could be in some cases, but it's not clear that it is. I mean, we need to compare those stuff more. But eventually, it's a possibility that this improvement could be associated with learning feature, but it's not clear with the other causes.
But it's a big bet these days, right? It's whether learning is crucial or priors are enough, and in the infinite dip limit, you get what you want. It's just the linear dynamics. It's also true that here, so maybe as you increase n, like we fix the margin, but the effective margin changes as you increase them. If you tune it, will you get better prediction?
That is super easy to do because you can do an infinity because you have the kernel. And so.
If you do the kernel, number, you don't get as good performance though.
Well, can you show us?
Yeah. maybe next week. I don't know. In a few weeks, we'll show that we have stronger results. But I mean, if you just do regular training, and if you, so this is gradient descent, it's ADAM, full batch ADAM. But if you do gradient descent, stochastic gradient descent, weight decay, momentum, whatever, they all the curves lie in between.
Yes. That's okay.
And their limit seems to be the same.
You still improve by averaging.
Yeah. And this dip is also consistent.
And also the other question is why do you have a range and instead not boost?
Boosting?
Boosting is a way of averaging in a clever way so that it's actually give you better performance. So if you have
weighted average.
It's an adaptive weight average and it's, you know, even if you have a stupid classifier that just gives you marginally better and random. If you take a lot of them, you can basically go to amazing performance, actually. Use a lot of processes. But not by the random people, it's more classical.
For our purposes, what we're interested in was reducing the fluctuations of the decision boundary in the input space, mm-hmm. and that you can do easily by just averaging the outputs. The induced boundary in the input space is smoother.
Because you can say something theoretically about it. Maybe in practice, what you're proposing is a good idea.
You'd be surprised what people have been able to say about boosting.
Looking at the mean as a function, you can understand this game.
I understand.
Remember, just coming to the wide minima and generalization. So, I mean, your point is that first, one has to be careful in defining. Why minima? Because maybe they are connected and just minimum in the same basin, mm-hmm. different parts. But again, I mean, all these things that, I mean, let's say, what if you go in minima that are around, are wider, you know, get a better generalization. So what's your take, or what's, I mean, the status of this? Okay, one thing is how to compute wideness, and two, whether if you compute it in a, let's say, reasonable way, you correlate with generalization.
In any way you measure, it correlates with generalization, except for some adversarial rescalings, because you can rescale the weights in such a way that you can take a good minima and make it sharper. But if you disregard that, and if you use the same training dynamics, and if you find two points with the same training dynamics by only changing the hyperparameters, the width measure correlates with good performance. That's, so it's not arguing against that, but the maybe and the mental picture we have is usually in those, at least in 2016 and 17, it was this separate minima. That's not the case. Probably it's not the case with different algorithms too. And the other thing is that so maybe, you know, this metastability results on Levy processes that tell you that this is not important. It only depends on the width. It works on this kind of nice landscapes. How can we use those ideas and extend it into this kind of landscapes? So what does this metastability theory tell us if the landscape is like this, and if we have a Levy noise, and if we the only notion of width is this degenerate notion of width that's only sensitive to one eigenvalue, not the other, what can we say theoretically about that?
But when you say Levy noise, I would guess that the noise you have is much bigger in the direction where the gradient is large.
Yes.
So there is this correlation. You could just compensate, right? In some sense, you have big noise when you're facing big, and so.
Yeah. So, I mean, in the mean square displacement, we also see a diffusive behavior. So maybe what's happening is that in this direction, it bounces back and forth like crazy. But in this direction, it's more nicer. Smoother.
Yes, but there are flat directions in which there is no noise at all. I mean, there is no...
Or maybe Gaussian kind of noise.
You don't even go there because
you
essentially have very little gradient.
And you kind of go because if this valley is like this, then it maybe shoots a little...
But let's say if you have some really flat direction where... I mean, you can find flat direction where the gradient for any data would be zero.
Yes.
Then you would never want to go there.
Yes. But
there are flat valleys that are sort of protected dynamically. You just don't even diffuse.
There are exact flat valleys. There are also approximate flat valleys. And maybe some fraction is exactly zero because of the dimensionality calculation. But there's also many, many tiny slopes also. So in those directions, you might move in a diffusive manner. But I mean, this other paper that showed that the gradient aligns with the top eigenspace of the Hessian is an indication that the fluctuations happen between these walls. But I don't know how to combine those two pictures of sharp wide basins and this flat minima in a more coherent way.
So for example, if you shuffle the labels, then the minimum, which is zero training loss, one would expect that it's not wide. Maybe everything is.
It might be. Another question is also the width, right? Yeah. We should test that and see whether it's true. Because it could also be possible that if you shuffle the labels, the fit you get has a large norm, and if you have a large norm, then the norm might induce a sharpness scaling. automatically, and
no other questions. Thank you.